You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello and welcome to the Write Club podcast, where we take you behind the pages and into the fascinating world of writing. I'm Mary and this is Beth, and we're part of the team at Writing Magazine and Writers Online. Hi Beth, how are you this morning?
Really good, thank you. And I can't wait to introduce our guest this week. We're thrilled to be joined by best-selling author Emma Cowell, a former actress and BBC presenter. Emma has worked in fundraising for children's charities for more than 17 years. For Emma, the move from being paid to talk for a living to writing was a natural progression, since storytelling has been at the heart of her career to date. Her best-selling novel, The One Last Letter from Greece, came out in 2022, followed by The House in the Olive Grove and now Under the Lemon Tree, which was released this May. Emma lives between Cornwall and Greece. Hiya Emma, how are you and where are we speaking to you from today?
Lovely to see you both, and thank you so much for having me. I am in sunny Cornwall, not quite as sunny as Greece at the moment, but I will take it. I can see the water. And so I'm in lovely Falmouth.
And is that your writing space? And could you describe it for us?
Yes, I am in my little writing room, right at the back of where we live. So it is floor to ceiling bookshelves, not just only my novels and the translated versions on the shelves. It's both my husband's and mine book collection. And I'd like to say it's just this room. It is not. It is in every room of the house. We've got so many bookshelves, but I've got on the walls opposite me sort of things that inspire me. One of my dearest friends who's an artist, I remember having this conversation with her years ago before I started writing, and she said that she wants to surround herself with beautiful, lovely things that inspire her, that feel, I don't know, give her an energy to create. And so I've kind of replicated that. So I've got family photographs, I've got a picture of Leonard Cohen and his cat, there's Freddie Mercury, there's paintings by friends of mine who are artists, there's Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn, and a great big Greek evil eye to ward off any bad vibes.
That's lovely. It looks gorgeous, and one of the elements in the latest book is about interior design, isn't it? So is that something that you're really interested in?
I am. I think it's just another outlet for creativity. I loved art when I was younger at school, and I did art for A-level as well. And I remember my art tutor saying, you have a really unique relationship with colour. And no one had ever suggested such a thing to me before. But I then realised that I really do see the world in a very sensory way. And interior design, I got the opportunity to gut renovate our kitchen in Cornwall. And it was so much fun, not only just to strip it back to nothing, which was quite traumatic, and you always know with a renovation that when you start something it's a pile of rubble and you can never imagine how it's going to be beautiful again, but to take a space and reimagine it, not just replicating the shapes of the units and things that were there before, really make it practical but make it beautiful. And so yes, interior design is something I've loved, so it was great fun to be able to thrust that upon Kat in Under the Lemon Tree.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Well, could you tell us a little bit about Under the Lemon Tree?
So with all of my books, they're all standalone novels. And what they all have in common is a beautiful Grecian backdrop, tons of delicious Greek food, and a story of self-discovery for the female protagonist. And usually it's connected with something dramatic happening in their lives, like grief, coming to terms with a loss. And for Kat, in Under the Lemon Tree, she is reeling from the death of her twin brother 6 months before we meet her. And she's half Greek. Her parents are very conservative, very orthodox. They run a restaurant in London. And as we enter the story, it's her 37th birthday, and it used to belong to her and her brothers, and now this is the first one that is hers alone. And of course, her family, because they're traditional, want to throw a huge, great big party, and it's the last thing she wants to do. And on her birthday, she learns that she's inherited a house from an uncle she didn't know she had. And so thus begins the family secret. She begins to unpeel the layers of her family who weren't all who she thought they were. And she begins this big journey of healing. She goes to Greece. But for Kat, she's 37. She's bereaved. Her marriage has ended. She longs to write fiction, but is trapped in this world of interior design journalism, which she does love, but it's not what her heart wants to do. So we go with her on an emotional roller coaster of a journey, a sweeping love story as well alongside, but it's really Kat's journey of working out who she is again.
Yeah, I loved it. It's really interesting, the kind of messy and neat elements within it. I kept thinking about that because she's quite chaotic and quite messy, and she meets this man who, and his house is perfect and his clothes are perfect, and I thought that was really interesting. And then the taking apart a house when and that's all messy, and then building it back up again, and sort of life, isn't it? You know, there's messy bits and
oh yeah it's the messy that makes us appreciate the neat and the beautiful things when they sometimes rarely happen. But I think for Kat to meet somebody who was such an opposite to her, with Andreas, the love interest, she calls him Mr. Linen when they first meet, and they really don't hit it off at all because she splashes him with Coca-Cola at the airport by mistake and ruins his beautiful cream linen trousers, which actually I did that to somebody at an airport, which is why it's ended up in the book. I know, I was mortified. It was very early at Newquay Airport, and I was flying up to London for work, and this poor man, I dropped a bottle of Coke on the floor and it bounced and splattered his jeans, like saturated it, not just a splash. I was unscathed and horrified and embarrassed. We didn't run off into the sunset and fall in love, but I bought him a coffee and then just sort of hid in a corner until I got on a flight and prayed that I wasn't sitting next to this poor man.
Honestly, that's my worst nightmare, but I feel like at some point in everyone's life you've done something like that, haven't you?
Oh, it's complete and utter cringe. But Kat has that chaos about her. She is so clumsy, and yet she at the same time creates these beautiful pages in this interior design magazine that are perfect and aspirational, not only for the readers but absolutely for her as well. But yeah, she drops food on herself, she's always got a splodge of something somewhere, and I really relate to that. You know, we all dream of being effortlessly fabulous and so well put together. I don't know how anyone has the time to do that, and I've certainly never been that girl.
No, me neither, absolutely not. But on that then, is she part of you then, like that character? Have you based her slightly on yourself? I know you mentioned about obviously that situation at the airport and the interior design, which is something that you're passionate about as well. Have you made her that because of yourself?
Not at all. At least I didn't intentionally. And I don't think I'm much like Kat, apart from we love interior design, we love food, we get splattered in it. But also there is a similarity in the way that she begins her fictional writing journey, channeling her grief, which is absolutely how I did during lockdown, trying to sort of unpick and make sense of the sudden death of my own mother some years before. She's been gone 11 years now. So there is that similarity. But I think for every author, when you write a character, there's always going to be an extension of some facet of you in there. You can't not, because you pour so much into writing, and it is the sleepless nights, the weeping, the writer's block, the I hate the whole thing, I need to delete it and start again, this is not a story, there's not enough here. All of those things you are so invested in that you can't help popping maybe bits of yourself, or certainly I pop bits of my friends' lives as well in there, and the crackers things that happen in our friend group that yes, need to be read to be believed. But there's a lot of truth in elements of my novels. But yes, it's Kat is fictional, but unintentionally there's some bits of me.
I think it helps, doesn't it, to be able to pull on your own experiences as well to make the story a bit more feel a bit more real and authentic as well. So I think, yeah, a lot of authors will do that, won't they? And all three of your novels are set in Greece. What is it about Greece that inspires you?
Oh, it's every single thing. I remember when I first went there, goodness, years and years ago now, it was really love at first sight. I couldn't try to describe that feeling of, you know, that moment when you step off a plane and that wall of heat hits you. And then I remember looking up to the peaks of the Peloponnese Mountains from Kalamata Airport, and there was a smell in the air that was wild herbs coming down on the breeze from the mountainside. And then I remember standing in the water, just going for a paddle, as you do, and just looking out at these cliffs. There's something about the sense of ancient history for me in Greece that resonates and speaks to maybe some deep ancient part of my own soul. And when I was a child, I was obsessed with myths and legends of ancient Greece. They were kind of like my fairy tales. Cinderella was a little tame for me, and I wanted to read about minotaurs and labyrinths and Medusas and all of those gods and heroes and goddesses. And so when I got to Greece and visiting the ancient digs and the tombs and the monuments to gods, something about it just sparked my love of Greece into life. And I feel like it's always been there. It just needed a moment. And then when I came to write, it felt like perfect sense to set my novels there, because I, by that time, knew Greece so well, particularly the mainland, that it was during lockdown and all I could think about was food and family and travel. And we were sort of denied those things and it was all restricted. So I started writing One Last Letter from Greece and put all of those things along with my own grief into that, with that authentic voice, like you say, I think. And the reader messages I get really validates that, that my experience of grief is real and raw within my novels, and people really respond to that. And also the same for Greek food. I spend a lot of time researching it to Verna's, guys. So, you know, my research is not in vain, along with the 6 pounds I gain every time I go to Greece.
You're doing some really important work there, doing all that research. So it's crucial.
It is. It's the Lord's work, and I'm happy to do it.
Someone's got to do it.
Right.
You take one for the team.
Always.
And obviously, so the setting is crucial in your novels. How do you think the setting of that novel influences the characters, the themes, and the overall mood of the story? And what role does it play in shaping the narrative?
It feels like Greece is almost an extra character in my novels. And I feel that the weather, the changeable weather, you know, it's not sunshine every day. It is 80% of the year, I've got to say. Let's not pretend. But sometimes when I've been there, say in September into October, you do get these crazy stormy, rainy days that do last only a day or two. And Greece transforms when the sky goes grey and the sea becomes a murky colour. You stop recognising it and you look around, and it's strange and it's beautiful as well. Its vibrant technicolour is so loud that when that mutes and dulls and becomes more like the Cornish weather, there's something extra for me that happens when Greece transforms and metamorphosizes in that way to an extent. So layering that onto characters and letting the sea state reflect their journey emotionally is great fun to do. And I don't always do these things intentionally. It just happens that I think my mood, the way I respond to a bad weather day in Greece or in Cornwall, it affects how we all feel. Goodness knows, we spend our lives in this country complaining about the weather, what to wear, where to go. Oh, it's terrible. It's never going to get light again in the winter. That stuff informs how we approach our day. And you can sit and do as many affirmations and as many downward dogs as you like. If it's raining and you've got to put the lights on when you get up and you keep them on the whole day, that stuff gets into my soul anyway and goes, oh, I need to be in the sun. I can't bear it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was on the way into the office this morning in a nice summer dress, mm-hmm. no jacket, and the heavens opened.
Yeah.
And the walk from our car park to the office is quite a walk, and I had no umbrella or anything, and oh my goodness, I got absolutely drenched. But then I've just looked out the window now, lovely blue skies.
Of course. I know, it's that inconsistency we are so used to living with that when I do go to Greece, and it removes all of this admin about, do I need a jacket? What do I wear today? Shall I take a jumper? Will I be cold? That waste of energy is removed. And all you have to do is put your pants on, a kaftan, and you're good until 10 o'clock that night. And then repeat the next day. It's a really freeing experience. And then you realize how much we obsess and talk about the weather when that's gone. And I think for all of my characters in all four of my novels, when they get to Greece, there is something that happens. It's either a crunch point, a liberating moment, and the loudness of the colour. There is no sky like a Greek cobalt midday sky, and the sea and the turquoise waters, the white sand. It is such a sensory assault, and it's liberating to just not have to worry about shoes, to not have to put makeup on, to not care about my frizz issues in my hair. You just roll with it and let Greece do its work.
Making me want to book a holiday so bad now.
Tell me about it. I spend my life looking for flights, going, when can I go back? When can I go back? It's calling me.
That's interesting, because a lot of in the novel, a lot of times people will say to Kat that they like her in Greece, that she's different in Greece.
Yeah, she has that. She finds a strength. And again, it's that liberation for her, because at 37, she's moved back home with her parents after her estrangement, which was an amicable choice from her husband, Jamie. So she's being smothered with food and Greek hospitality and love, and everyone's making decisions for her, and it's driving her crackers. When she gets to Greece, she's alone and suddenly starts to stand up for herself, finding her voice, which is the beginning of a real journey to unearth who she really is. But yeah, she's changed in Greece, and I love that feistiness that comes forward for her.
Yeah, I did. Really enjoyed it. We featured you in our Shelf Life article in July's Writing Magazine, and you said, I always have a signature candle for each book, a playlist and photographs from my years of Greek trips. It wakes up my sensory muscle memory and helps me mute the noise of the day and focus. I love that. It's something that I do too, creating flow state, especially with scent. And I wanted to ask what the scent of this novel was. I'm guessing lemon, but...
You got it. I mean, the lemony business is out of hand, especially after publication. I've got readers sending me lemon tablecloth pictures. Someone sent me a bag. I've got lemon earrings still in. I've taken the lemons off of my nails for now, but it was a lemon scented candle, and I have ADHD, so I need to find tools that work for me to focus my brain. And for the most part, I don't have trouble doing that with writing, because I've built this, I suppose, toolkit to switch off my day from my work, my day job, which is full time, to then go, right, this is writing time. The lemon candle went on. My playlist, which had a lot of Greek folk music. There's this wonderful, much renowned folk singer, Dimitris Mitropanos, that I recognize his music from being played in tavernas for years before I started writing, and fell in love with that music. So he was playing, and then I had these little Polaroid size snapshots I'd printed out with prompts. So there's a picture of the beach or the church at the end of Egistri, the pine forests in the middle, and loads of plates of food, of course, and beautiful Greek cats that are inescapable throughout the country. So, and a little red evil eye that I found on the Greek mainland in the shallows. And that's a really important bit in the story, because the cat, her twin brother, always had this red evil eye, or the mati, as the Greeks call it, to ward off demons and bad energy. And she has it with her all the time after her brothers died. I actually found a red evil eye. And everyone, I think, is familiar with the blue evil eyes that are much more common. I remember walking along the beach, sea glassing, finding bits and bobs on the beach first thing in the morning when the sea is like a mill pond, just having a break from writing. And my eye just caught this glimpse of red in the shallows, and I waded out and picked it up, and I thought, what is this? And this was the year before I started writing Under the Lemon Tree, and I thought, this has to go somewhere in a book. I was meant to find this evil eye. It's been cleansed by the sea. Who knows how long it's been there? It's been sent to me for a reason, and hopefully it brings me good luck. So I popped it into Under the Lemon Tree. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. And I read at the end of your book, you talk about losing your cat, and that's why you wanted to include a cat in the. And I loved the cat in the story, and I kept thinking, oh, what's he telling us? Like, why does
Yes.
that keep coming? So.
Yeah, Patch the cat in the novel. Actually, it's 1 year today since we lost our little fur baby Papushka. And oh my goodness, the cats in our lives, especially on holidays, we always have a holiday pet. Whenever we go to Greece, they find us. And my husband is such an animal lover as I am, and end up spending a fortune on tins of sardines and tuna for the holiday cats. Also, not only just to have them around, but to make sure they get through the winters because they're all wild and feral and they're scavenging for their next meal. So if we can spend a huge amount of our holiday budget, I might add, on lovely tins of food to keep them going, then that's what we do. And it's funny, Papushka, our little baby who we had for 18 years, she found us. We didn't get her from anywhere. She moved in with us, and it's that wonderful thing. And I didn't particularly love cats before I met her. I was a dog person, had dogs throughout our childhood, and this one was way more like a dog, and she moved in with us and chose us. And you think, well, I will take that. She's been sent to us for a reason, whatever that is. And so I wanted to write a cat in a novel just because they're ever present in Greece and they're so pretty. A Greek cat is something very special about them. They're either really feisty and you can't get near them because they'll hiss and spit at you, or they're really timid and nervous, and you just want to go, "You're okay, little one. I'll look after you for the month or two I'm here." So, yes, Patch the cat has a very important role, I feel, and I'm glad you got that he had a message for everybody, which is revealed eventually, his little role.
Yeah, I love that. How would you describe your novels, and what would you like readers to experience whilst they're reading them?
Think, and I hope that my stories are uplifting, ultimately. I don't shy away from issues within the books. They're all very different. As I said, they're all standalone. But the first novel, One Last Letter from Greece, had issues about infertility, coercive control. The second book, The House in the Olive Grove, had issues about community and people who are ostracized for being different. The Island Love Song is about sibling relationship that we don't always love who we're related to, and for two sisters really going to battle about secrets and the roles of siblings. And Under the Lemon Tree again is about family drama and secrets and grief and coming to terms with where you fit in the world. And that is what they all absolutely have in common, is for the female protagonists, whether it's one or three, like in The House in the Olive Grove, they're all trying to understand at their stage of life where they fit into not only their world, but their families and friends' world and the wider world. And particularly for Kat at 37, my goodness, I've got 11 years on her now. And at 37, life changes sometimes on the turn of a dice. And my late mum died when I was 36. So if I think back to when I was 37, I was absolutely reeling with that grief and coming to terms with what the world looked like without her and who I wanted to be to make her proud. And all of those things, as women, we grapple with throughout our years. And I would think, God, if I met myself in my 20s, I would think I was a stranger compared to when I start to push far too close to 50. But I think they all have in common, all of my novels, love, uplifting, hope, and healing, and oodles of Greek food, always.
Oh, perfect. And like you mentioned, the grief kind of runs through the story of Under the Lemon Tree,
Yeah.
which is something that everybody experiences in their life at some point or another. And but how does writing about it help you to make sense of it both personally and in a way that helps sort of other people to relate to that and connect with others?
There is certainly a catharsis in writing about grief and pulling on my own experience of that, whether it's a grandparent and sadly my mother, and that I have that very loud, life-changing grief to experience. And like you say, everyone has an experience to a degree of grief. And I think when you're younger and you perhaps experienced it for the first time, and hopefully it's in the natural order of things, that is with a grandparent and not somebody younger. but also I have had miscarriages in my life. And so to be able to put that into some element of fiction and write that authentically, not to shy away from grief, because we're not very good at talking about it because it makes us uncomfortable, because no one wants to talk about their own mortality, which is what grief does. It sort of puts you a step closer towards your end, which no one wishes to think about. However, fiction is a place to explore that. And it's clearly a subject I'm drawn to, because even though my mum has been gone 11 years, I'm still making sense of it. I still feel the silence at 7 o'clock every evening when we would speak. So that stuff never goes away. And all those terrible things that people say to you when you're bereaved, oh, time's a healer, they're in a better place. And you just want to punch the wall or them and say, that's just such nonsense. Time isn't a healer, but in a sense, you just learn over time how to live with a heart that's less full. And that's all it is. You live with a space in your life and you somehow start to come to terms with it as much as you ever do. So to be able to put that in fiction as a warning to people, supporting people who are bereaved, but also to write my experience of the terrible accidental things that people say because they're so terribly uncomfortable and don't know what to say. It's just better to say, I'm here for you, I'm sorry, than say, oh, they're in a better place now, they're out of pain. No one was in pain, stop it. The best place is here. It's like, enough. But I understand how we get there because we're so rubbish at chatting about grief.
Yeah, absolutely. I had this similar situations after I lost my granddad, which was in 2017. So that, and I was only 17. Was I 17 or was I 18? I can't remember. But yeah, it was a really traumatic time for me and my family. And I just remember sitting there in my nan's house and just watching everybody go on with their lives.
Yeah.
And I just thought, how on earth can we be sat in this house right now whilst people are driving past the front window, people are walking their dogs, and they're just carrying on like everything's normal? And it's so hard to get to grips with. And it's similar thing in that it's been such a long time, and yet I still think about him every single day. I still speak to my nan, and my nan, I saw her last weekend, and I went into her house, bless her, and she said to me, she had music on full blast and my granddad was a massive music fan. He played the guitar, he sang everything, and she said to me, I'm really proud of myself today. And I said, why? What's going on? And she said, this is the first time I've been able to listen to music in 8 years.
Wow.
And not sobbed. And I was like, go on, Nan, I'm proud of you.
Yes, yes. But it's those moments that you take the wins when you get out of bed or you do something in honour of someone and you don't break apart and you can't function for the next hour or the rest of the day or the week. The thing about that you describe so perfectly is that jarring sense of grief that when you're in it, there's sometimes no reason or rationale as to why you'll suddenly have gone from 0 to 1,000 with rage or anger or resentment. That how dare people continue on with their lives when I am trapped in this gloom, my heart is weighing me down, and physically grieving is exhausting. It truly is. And I think to capture elements of that in fiction, again, the messages I receive from readers about grief and sharing their really personal stories with me, which I'm so grateful to receive, that resonates with them because they feel a moment, they feel heard and seen, and all those very complex feelings we endure when we're grieving, which it never goes in a straight line. There aren't X amounts of stages of grief. There's a million of them because it's unique to you as a person. It's unique to the relationship you had with the person who's died. So all of those platitudes and self-help books, they don't make sense for all of us. And so when I get readers' messages and they say, I feel validated, I had that feeling, you write it as I was feeling it or as I felt. And then to have people who have been bereaved, who find that sense of hope and uplifting comfort from my writing, gives me just more joy than I could ever have imagined when I first started writing. I was ill prepared for those emails and DMs filled with wonderful words encouraging me. So I spend most of my time crying, but from joy. It's just so overwhelming. I think all those things people say about social media, that it's a cesspit of vipers and things. And yes, there's unpleasant elements to it, but to have a way to reach directly to your readers and vice versa, directly to an author who's writing you love, is the most special thing. You know, never tag an author in something that you hated. It ruins their day and their week. But saying lovely things to someone whose work you've enjoyed is just magical. It's so special, and I don't take it for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such an important topic to write about as well, isn't it? So yeah, I think everybody should get a copy of the book, and all four of the books.
Well, I completely agree with you. Thank you, Beth. But it's, you know, it's a privilege to write about in that sense. But within that, all the stories are uplifting and joyful. And there's a lot of humour in Under the Lemon Tree as well. So it's not all doom and gloom and grief in Greece. It's very hard to distinguish sometimes. But, you know, they're fun. They're women's issues. And there's love. Who doesn't want love and Greek food? I do.
Yeah. And what is your writing process? Are you a plotter or pantser?
Oh, God, I wish I was a plotter so badly, because there's always a moment at 30,000 or 60,000 words. Latterly, it's become the 60,000 block of the 100,000 first draft or so, where I despair. I lose my mind. There's not enough story here to get to the end. What am I doing? I hate it. I just don't think it's working. It's the most torturous moment to get to, and I don't know why I haven't found a way out of it yet. However, that being said, in my pantsterness, I have started, upon the advice of other great author friends, bullet pointing five chapters ahead with just the idea of the main thing that happens in that chapter to progress the plot and the big storylines. I also feel, though, if I plotted too hard, I would lose that sense of freedom that I really enjoy when it's going well, of my characters leading me astray sometimes, or leading me to unexpected places. And if I was fastidious about it, I may lose some of that fun, spontaneous writing that comes out of the blue and inspiration strikes. Or I would feel like I've wasted my time and done myself a disservice by plotting so hard. And because time is precious, when you have a full-time job and I write in the evenings and weekends, I haven't got time to waste on procrastinating, which God knows I spend enough time faffing around, tidying cutlery drawers instead of sitting down and writing. But so when the time comes, I need to make it count.
So as you said, you work full-time. So I was going to ask you what your writing day typically looked like, but I guess you're taking moments where you can, are you, or is it evenings
for sure? And Sunday, if I'm at home in Cornwall, or if I'm in Greece, then Sunday is my big all-day writing day. But most evenings, especially where I am, I'm writing book five at the moment, so I'm on the last stretch, like the last less than a quarter to go of that, so I know where I'm headed and the momentum is building. So at the moment, it's every evening for a good 2 hours after the day job finishes, and then really get stuck in. And then, yeah, a bit on Saturday sometimes, or I'll read what I've written yesterday. And then Sunday is a really forge onwards for as many thousand words as I can. But without that pressure, I don't do word counts. It's good to get at least a chapter down every 2 days or in a day sometimes. But yeah, but in Greece, it's very different for me. Just because being in the air that smells of Greece and trying to capture that on the page, it's not that it comes easier, it flows in a very different way. Being able to watch the sunset across the sea when I'm sat with my laptop and pouring a glass of rosé, there's a real different sense that I get, and an energy as well, because when I'm in Greece, I will take time away from the day job and just do the writing. So it feels like a real treat to be able to focus on it full time for a change.
I feel like you can really put the colour in there as well when you're experiencing it.
So much so. I went to, there's a beautiful island called Hydra, and that's where I set my third novel, The Island Love Song. And I went there several years ago because I was researching Greek Easter, which is book two. The House in the Olive Grove is set at Greek Easter. And I wanted to go and experience it because A, it's not my culture. I'm not Greek. And I take great care and pains to write it with the love and respect it deserves. So I wanted to feel and breathe and experience Greek Easter for myself. So I went to Hydra, which is a beautiful island just off of Athens, really, almost 2 hours in a boat. And there's no cars on the island. The only way to get around is by foot, by water taxi, or on horseback. So romantic already. And I didn't plan to set a book there ever. I was going to see the tradition of Greek Easter unfurl across the week in the build-up to Easter Sunday, because it's apparently one of the best places in Greece to experience it. And being there and experiencing it was so unique. And I'd begun to write that novel already, but being there, I got that authenticity, the smell of the tzourekis bread that they take to church on Holy Thursday to be blessed by the priest, and then the red painted eggs are put within the dough, and the sound of the church bells relentlessly clanging for these all-day services that happen as we get towards Good Friday, and then the procession, oh my goodness, on Good Friday, and then on Easter Saturday, and the fireworks that mark the moment of resurrection. Honestly, it was colour I would never have been able to get just Googling online or watching the odd video. And so I really do put myself in the thick of the place that I'm writing about to be authentic. And as you say, the colour, and I can make Greece come to life on the page for a reader who's either never been there or will never go to the particular place I've written about. So that's great fun. And as I said, the research is so hard. Going to Greece, sitting in Taverna, stuffing my face, you know, it's really, really challenging for me.
I mean, that's brilliant advice to try and immerse yourself in the world that you're writing about. Yeah. But it's not always possible. Do you have any advice for aspiring authors?
I think there's this great adage that everyone says about writing what you know, which isn't false, but writing what you feel is an extra level of truth that you can share with a reader, hopefully, when you're first starting out. Because as we've spoken about, those authentic moments that shape us and change us are usually universal to everybody in the world, and grief is one of them. Love is another, hopefully. And so to write those things that you feel, to put it on the page somehow in whatever form, just get that blank document to be populated with something. It is so intimidating. I do it every time I start a new book, although I always know the beginning, the middle, and the end, and the journey of the main character to an extent, and the place. I always start with the place. But sitting there going, oh, book four, book five, book six by Emma Cowell, and then begin to obsess about what it's going to be called, which is not my ultimate decision, so that's a waste of time. Just, if you want to write, write. Whatever it is, once you find a rhythm, once you find a flow, you will soon work out whether you can do it or not. And my goodness, the discipline and motivation you need to force yourself in front of your laptop, because you know, there aren't that many writers, unless you're uber successful, who are able to do it full time, depending on your personal circumstances. So a lot of writers, you're in your spare time and at weekends. So you've got to have that, A, the love for it and the motivation and discipline to force yourself in front of the laptop and at least write something, even if it's a sentence or rereading your draft from the beginning. You're investing energy and something on the page, and that will resonate eventually when someone else reads it.
Oh, that's brilliant advice. Thank you. We always end by asking for a book recommendation. Do you have one for us?
Oh, I've recently reread again for the third time The List of Suspicious Things by Jenny Godfrey. And I love Jenny. She is a glorious human being. This book, for it to be a debut as well, is astonishing. And it's set at a time that I think people of a certain age will be aware of the Ripper murders in Yorkshire. But the way she's brought to life that period of time, and a lot of people will remember, maybe if you're my age, from your grandparents, like Formica, tables or linoleum on the kitchen floor. There's some really evocative period details, and she's built this magical world. I love the fact that the protagonists are two young friends, Miv and Sharon, who feel that they can solve the Ripper murders because it's all everyone around them is talking about. It is charming, it is moving, it is funny. And Jenny doesn't shy away from so many issues like racism, abuse, alcoholism. They are all woven into this uplifting, joyful story about community and a list of suspicious things. So if nobody has read it, I urge you to read it. It is astonishing. My husband's read it 4 or 5 times. I never have the time to read a book more than once. This one I've gone back to again, and I expect I will again at some point. It's heavenly.
Oh, sounds fantastic.
It is.
Yeah, brilliant. I'll be adding that to my ever-growing list of books to read.
And I can tell you, just to do an extra, I know you only asked for one. There's a book out in August by Helen Fields. Helen, when I'm writing, I read crime and gruesome horror, psycho thriller things because I never want to be influenced. Helen Fields, she is a friend and she's blonde. We have the same hair and she is a barrister. She is one of those boss women who I want to be when I grow up, even though we're a very similar age. And she writes the most twisted, dark things you could ever imagine to come out of this beautiful blonde's head. And I love her for that because she is so twisted and so brilliant. And all of her books haunt my sleep. I love them, read them, read any of hers. They are brilliant. If you like psychological crime type thriller vibes, this will keep you up all night with your heart thumping in your ears.
Yeah, I have actually just not that long ago finished reading Perfect Remains.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And genuinely, the whole way through, I was thinking, how on earth does somebody come up with this?
I know, her search engine history must be so questionable. I'm grateful she's not been arrested, but she's skilled enough to get herself out of it, being a barrister, so she's fine.
This is true, she can get away with it, can't she?
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, I absolutely second that, would fully recommend her books.
Yeah.
So brilliant. Thanks so much for joining us on the Write Club today. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. And Emma's book, Under the Lemon Tree, is out now.
Thank you so much for having me. And now I'm going to go and Google flights to Greece and maybe cook some Greek food because I made myself hungry chatting about to the burners.
Yeah, same. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a treat to chat. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the Write Club. We hope you enjoyed this episode and feel inspired to keep writing. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at Writers Online, your go-to for writing tips, competitions, and exclusive updates. Plus, you'll never miss an episode of the Write Club. Until next time, happy writing.